that bad wolf, while maybe it doesn't need to be fed, it needs to be acknowledged at least. I think when we ignore that dark side, that's kind of when trouble starts to bubble up.
Welcome to The One You Feed. Throughout time, great thinkers have recognized the importance of the thoughts we have. Quotes like garbage in, garbage out, or you are what you think ring true. And yet, for many of us, our thoughts don't strengthen or empower us. We tend toward negativity, self-pity, jealousy, or fear. We see what we don't have instead of what we do. We think things that hold us back and dampen our spirit. But it's not just about thinking. Our actions matter. It takes conscious, consistent, and creative effort to make a life worth living. This podcast is about how other people keep themselves moving in the right direction, how they feed their good wolf. Thanks for joining us. Our guest on this episode is John Worster, an American musician and humorist, best known as the drummer for indie rockers Superchunk, Bob Mould, and the Mountain Goats. He's also known for his comedic work with radio host Tom Sharpling on The Best Show on WFMU. Let's check out the interview.
Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. I have to tell you that I'm probably going to have a hard time at first taking you seriously because I've heard your voice for hours and hours, and in almost every case when I hear that voice, you are playing some jackass or the other on the radio on The Best Show. So it may take me a little while to get used to you actually being you.
That's okay. I actually get that a lot.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. So our podcast is called The One You Feed, and it's based on the parable of two wolves where there's a grandfather, and he's talking with his grandson, and he says, in life, there are two wolves inside of us. One is a good wolf, which represents kindness and love and bravery, and the other is a bad wolf, which represents hate and greed and fear and pick your poison. And the grandson stops, and he thinks for a second. He says, well, grandfather, which one wins? And the grandfather says, the one you feed. So what I'd like to start the interview off with is asking you what that parable means to you in your life.
You know, obviously it means you try to live your life in a way where you are, you're engaged in the good side, the good parts of yourself, and you treat others and interact with others from that good side. But I also think, the more I kind of get into this, that bad wolf, while maybe it doesn't need to be fed, it needs to be acknowledged at least. I think we all have a light and a dark side. And I think when we ignore that dark side, that's kind of when trouble starts to bubble up. Like I said, I don't think you need to feed that bad wolf, but I do think it needs to be acknowledged and even shown some compassion while not exactly feeding it.
Yeah, exactly. I actually think for some of us, that bad wolf is pretty good at feeding himself.
Yes.
And you're right, but that complete suppression and trying to be someone we're not seems to get a lot of people into trouble.
Yeah, and I think that's where a lot of dark and bad behavior comes from. People have that dark side or the negative side, and they're so afraid of it that they push it down until eventually it does kind of show itself in the form of bad and negative behavior.
Yeah. So I know that you are, I think in our emails we talked a little bit about how you are a reader of, I'm never a fan of the term self-help books, but for lack of a better word, I'm gonna go with that one, and that you tend to read some things in that area. Are there any books you could talk about that you've read lately that you really like, or maybe just even all-time favorites of yours that you've drawn a lot from?
Yeah, it's funny, when I was preparing for today, I realized that I have tons of these books. I buy them all the time, and a lot of them I have just kind of sat on the shelf. But I have read a lot of them, and I pulled a handful of the ones that I've liked recently. And So one is called The Untethered Soul by Michael Singer. And that's kind of a, you know, kind of a, examining our connection to whatever you want to call it. God is such a loaded word at this point, I think, that I tend not to use that word. But, you know, the connection to source or where we're from or where we originated. And that's a really good one. I love that. I got this book somewhere on tour, and it's crazy, but I loved it. It's called A Journey Toward Forgiveness, The Afterlife Apologies of Adolf Hitler. And it's...
Boy, that...
Yes, go ahead.
That sounds like... if I didn't know better, I would actually think that that was something you just made up.
But. I know. It sounds insane, but it's... You know, you take some of these books with a grain of salt, and you just kind of... I just read them and see if there's anything in there that resonates with me. And this really did. And it's obviously a guy kind of channeling Hitler on the other side. And, but it's got a lot of great stuff about self-forgiveness and that sort of thing. And, you know, whether or not you believe that this guy's actually in touch with Hitler, the kernels of information in there affected me, and I thought they were really good. One of the first books that I really got into I got into this stuff in the late 80s. I was having a really dark time. I was living in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and I was playing in a band, and basically we had gotten signed to Arista Records by Clive Davis. I joined the band, and 2 months later, we get signed. And I was 19. And it's one of those things where you think everything's, wow, this is exactly what I want to do. The ball is rolling. I didn't really have to pay too many dues, and I'm on a major label. And then, of course, things went to shit pretty immediately. And I just kind of found myself in this depression. And I realized a lot of it was kind of rooted in childhood. My dad had an alcohol problem when I was like 13, 14, 15. And so a lot of that stuff kind of started coming up. And along with a lot of kind of church damage that I think a lot of people suffer when they're kids. But the church I went to was not at all oppressive, but I just kind of developed this massive fear of religion and dying. And so I discovered this book called We Don't Die, just in the mall that I worked at. I worked at a record store, and it's by a guy named Joel Martin. And basically it's just sort of talking about near-death experiences and that was kind of the first thing that really hooked me into this. And then I found a book by a woman named Pat Rodegast, R-O-D-E-G-A-S-T, and she was a friend of Ram Dass's, and it's also a kind of channeled book too. This energy called Emmanuel. It's basically at our core we are loved and we are love, etc. And so that kind of really got me through this dark time. And from there, I just kind of got into more and more of these books like Papaji and Byron Katie and Wayne Dyer and Neil Donald Walsh, all that stuff.
So you got into that in an original time when you were struggling a little bit in a dark period.
Yeah.
Which could have probably been from the label thing, or maybe just working in a mall in the record store. That might have been the whole problem right there.
It certainly was. My darkest days were at the record bar. they really were.
The only thing, it could be worse if you had to work in a guitar store. I think that might be the third level of hell.
Much louder, yeah.
Yeah. So that was a period then. You've clearly kept that interest. Has depression been something that you have wrestled with on and off since then?
Yeah.
And you've gone back to these sources as things to sort of help keep you out of that?
Yeah. And that's why I keep all these books too, because I do actually go back to them. Even if I haven't read one of these for 10 years, I'll often be compelled to go over to the bookshelf and pick up the book that I read 10 years ago that helped me, that I hadn't thought about in 10 years. So yeah, they help me get through a lot. I've been engaged in therapy for the last couple years too, and that's been very helpful. And you know, it's kind of where I am.
So you brought up church damage, and one of the things I've heard you talk about before is I think you keep a list of words that you hate, or the most hated words, or what's it called?
It's called Word Hate Trademark.
Okay. And I think I heard you once saying that when you analyzed that, you realized that an awful lot of those words came from, they were from a church setting.
Yes. And like I said, my church was not oppressive at all. Somehow it never felt right to me. But a lot of these words that I don't like, and they're just like, I just have an immediate discomfort when I hear them. And they're all kind of based in the church I went to. And they're all food related too. I guess when I was a kid, they served food after the church service. So meal, I don't like. Covered dish, I don't like. I always refer to this. When Obama was inaugurated the first time, he had a brunch. There's another word. After he was sworn in, and it's online. It's on YouTube. I think Barry Black was the minister who did the prayer. Another word at this brunch, and he managed to hit like 20 of these words in his prayer. And so if you go online and you search this, you'll hear 20 of my least favorite words of all time, kind of just flying out there.
Where's cold cuts?
Cold cuts is in there too. But that's a term I rarely hear anymore. But that's a good one. Thank you for reminding me.
That's definitely one of mine. I don't know what it is about that word, cold cuts.
Yeah.
So what are some of the most recent entries to Word Hate, and how many words are in it?
You know, I've never kept a full list, which I probably should do, but I'm kind of into the fact that I don't have a written list. Recent ones, mouthfeel. Do you know mouthfeel?
Yeah, I think it's foodies use it.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Unless it's used in an erotic sense, then maybe we could get into mouthfeel.
I'm very into that then. Yes. My main problems right now are these commercials that have. Walt, every commercial now has a ukulele in it.
Yes.
That is killing me.
There's a lot of ukulele music on commercials, and there's a lot of ukulele music in new podcasts.
Yes.
That's the other thing I've noticed. It does seem to be everywhere all of a sudden the last 2 years. And when I hear it, I think of a Volkswagen commercial. I don't know but that's what it brings up in my mind.
The whistling and tapping and the stomping, that's a whole thing now too.
And the whistling.
Oh.
Yep. Actually, we've got, I think there's a ukulele in this room. We could make my co-host here play a ukulele song with all of the Word Hate words.
But see, I'm glad you brought this up, because all of these things are things I need to get over. Like I shouldn't be bothered by this stuff. So that's something I'm trying to work out too. Why does a ukulele bother? Like, I take personal offense to it. Like, I take things way too personally. And like, yeah, I take personally the fact that this ad agency approved this ukulele in this commercial. What does that say about me?
I'm not sure. Chris, any ideas?
I was wondering if there was maybe some childhood trauma involved with the ukulele.
No, you know what?
Like, show me on the ukulele where Uncle Billy touched you.
Exactly. I think what it is, you know, I have a distrust of anyone that has never been into punk rock. Like, that bothers me. And so this whole sort of teensification of music and stuff bothers me. Like, everything is tiny now, you know? Like the whistling and the ukulele, so it's so far away from punk that it bothers me. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah. I think is interesting is when you just said that, I thought about Chris was sort of acknowledging too, like that sort of distrust of people who weren't into punk music. And I was thinking, I used to have that a lot, and I think I still have a little bit of it, but I've spent enough time at this point. I've done a lot of different consulting work. So I've been in the corporate world on and off enough that I've sort of just, it's just been worn out of me over time of just like, and realizing like, oh yeah, that guy didn't like the Replacements, and he doesn't really know who Black Flag is, but he's still a pretty decent guy.
Exactly. Right?
Like, we can have lunch. There's, you know, he hasn't committed any crime against humanity. Mm-hmm. But my initial reaction is to go there. But now that you mentioned, I noticed that decreasing over time through you know, forced exposure.
One of my many problems.
One of the bits you do as you call into Tom Sharpling and you play a variety of characters. One of the things you go back to all the time is mispronouncing words.
Yes.
Is that tied to the word hate thing? And does Sharpling have a similar aversion?
We have words. Tom will have a word that really bothers him, and he will. We'll write it into a bit, and then he will say, I want you to say that word 7 times. Like, I want you to say it over and over again until I just tell you to stop. I'm trying to think of an example of one of those words.
Buffet.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. But the malapropisms, I'm not sure where that started, but there's the funniest thing to us is someone who is dead certain of either a fact or like we're talking about a pronunciation. And then when they're called on it, they can't believe that they're wrong. And
right. And oh, it is hilarious.
Yeah. Like, I'll mispronounce the word and then, what do you think it is? And then he'll say, it actually a real life example of that was, Do you know Howard Stern show?
Sure.
Gary, the assistant guy, his nickname is Baba Booey. And I guess the way that originated was he came in one day and he was talking about he had bought these animation cells. And he's kind of rattling off the characters of the cells that he bought. And one of them was supposed to be Baba Louie. And he mispronounced it as Baba Booey. And they just get on him so much for this, and he eventually goes, well, what is it? It's Baba Booey, right? And of course, for the next 30 years or whatever, he has had to suffer with this name.
Yeah, that's a shtick that works remarkably well. The other one of the ones you've done on the best show that my kids and I were cracking up over was when you were a basketball coach and you were talking about Bobby Knight and Suge Knight, that they were in the same family.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And you were so adamant that it absolutely was true. And it's good stuff. Do you have a favorite character out of those that you play?
The one that is closest to me and the one that's my natural default one to go into is Philly Boy Roy. And because I grew up just outside of Philadelphia, and people don't really believe that that's a real accent, because it's obviously I do an extreme version of it, but that's a real accent around there. It's crazy. It's almost English. It's very close to the Baltimore accent, and so it's based on a few different people that I knew when I was younger. And it's just an easy persona to throw on.
So the best show recently ended, and it seems like it really picked up a lot of steam and popularity. It ended, I think, at the peak of its popularity, and I saw the article today. I think it was today on the AV Club that was a really good article about the ending. What are you guys up to now? Because I think I've heard that you and Tom are on to other things in the comedy realm.
Yeah, we are just working on that right now. We've got a bunch of irons in the fire, and we definitely want to keep the show alive in a venue that, you know, that is a venue that we're able to actually make some money in. That was a thing that was tough over the years. We did this thing for 13 years and we loved doing it, but it was kind of tough after a while. We're not making anything off of this at all. And seeing other people doing that, you know, so finally we just decided that, you know, let's see if we can try it somewhere else. And we love FMU. You know, we couldn't have asked for a better venue to do it in. You know, who else is going to let us do these 35, 45 minute uninterrupted calls? You know, there just is nowhere else that would, where we could do that and reach that many people. But it just kind of reached its end.
You're on the road pretty consistently?
Yeah, somewhere around 2008, I just really started. It was interesting. I moved to New York City, to Brooklyn with my then girlfriend, and we ended up splitting up. And it was right at the same time that I started getting all these gigs, like Bob Mould and the Mountain Goats, and Superchunk started getting back into business, and I was playing with Carl Newman from the New Pornographers. And so since then, it's been, you know, 5-6 years of touring with never more than 3 weeks of a break. And that's also when my decision to stop drinking came about, also was during those first couple years of the nonstop touring, where, you know, you find yourself between loading in your gear and loading out at the end of the night. I had 8 drinks, you know, and every day for 2 years. And that kind of took its toll. So that's another reason for what we're talking about tonight, you know, the self-awareness and the self-improvement and that.
Did you find that drinking exacerbated
depression? Yeah. And I realized it always felt like false happiness. You know what I mean? Like it almost felt like cheating to me to be drunk, because you're just not dealing with your actual problems. You're just kind of covering them up, and then you wake up the next day and you feel terrible. You feel terrible about yourself, and it just kind of repeats itself. And I completely understand why anybody in a rock band drinks, you know, because it's so boring too. You're doing nothing for basically 20 hours a day, pretty much. And right. So I started to really drink on a tour that Superchunk did of Europe in 96, where I was just drinking to get through the day at that point. And I thought, God, this was terrible. And that didn't force me to stop at all, but, you know, it all catches up with you at some point.
Yeah, I think it's that cycle that you talk about over and over and over again. I know people in my life who drink, and they go out and they've had a shitty day and they go have some drinks and they feel better, and it's fine, right? They just do it once in a while, and there's nothing to it. And I don't think it stops them from getting to the things that they need to address in their life, where some of us, on the other hand, it's that desire to cover up the problems and to feel different is so strong that it just becomes a constant thing. Has it been a challenge for you? Because you are in a situation, you're in a rock and roll lifestyle, which to some degree is certainly surrounded by and associated with.
Yeah, it is like the worst possible scenario for someone who was trying to deal with that. You have free alcohol all night long. Right. But I read this book by this guy named Alan Carr, who English guy, and he wrote a book called The Easy Way to Stop Smoking, and he wrote an alcohol one also, The Easy Way to Stop Drinking. And that kind of worked for me. I read it, and you still drink as you read this book. And then at the end of the book, you have what is in theory your last drink. And coming up in June, that'll be 5 years since I finished that book. And somehow being around the alcohol at clubs or whatever, it wasn't a big thing, because it's more important to me to feel good. And I get, when I started touring without it, I would get this weird high or thrill of going out in front of a couple thousand people or whatever and playing sober. I got a lot of don't know, pride, I guess, coming off stage and thinking, wow, I did that completely sober. Yeah, I just never stopped, really, it's been easy for me, thankfully.
Yeah, that's good. It sounds like you've got the positive reinforcement of it. My partner here, Chris, read that book and used it to stop smoking.
Oh, right? Yeah. And also my dad, who I mentioned earlier, my dad, as I said, struggled with alcoholism when I was in my teens, and he is a major success story and a major inspiration to me. I don't think he's had a drink since maybe 87 or something. So, you know, he's been a real source of help and guidance also.
One of the things that, at least for myself, that I know, back to the theme of feeding your good wolf or of finding positive inspiration, is music in general, and then maybe particularly certain types of music or certain artists. Is there any particular musicians or bands that give you that same sort of feeling or that positive inspiration?
Yeah, I think, like a lot of people, you take the most inspiration and the most excitement from the music you liked when you were first getting into music. Like, and so for me, that would be London Calling by The Clash was the record that really just made the hugest impression on me when that came out. I remember buying it. I was lucky to find a copy in New York City. I went there with my mom and dad, my brother, to see West Side Story. And I was able to find one copy of it that didn't have a parental sticker on it. That album, when it came out, had an offensive lyric sticker on it, but this one didn't. So that was a record that made a huge impact on me. And then, you know, I loved those first, you know, when R.E.M. started putting records, I loved that stuff. And Husker Du, and I'm so lucky to play with Bob Mould, and I get to play a lot of those songs. Replacements, Paul Westerberg, you know, a lot of that stuff. And I find myself going back to that, and those are the records that still give me the chills.
We must be similarly aged, because all those records and times pretty much ring true. How did you get started into playing music? Because you said by the time you were 19, you had moved to a new town to join a band that seems like they were on their way and had a major record label deal. When and how did you get started?
Well, I just always liked seeing bands on TV, like American Bandstand and those kind of TV shows. And I always focus on the drummer. And like when you're a kid, drums are just sort of exotic. Like they look cool, and you just want to touch them and beat on them. So I took lessons for like 6 months, and I didn't like the lessons, because when you're a kid, you're just given this little drum pad, and you have to kind of do these rudiments, and none of it is fun, and you know.
Yep,
and
yep.
So I stopped, but then I still wanted to play the drums. My parents, I was so lucky to have supportive parents. I come from a very non-musical family. Nobody really played an instrument. And they gave me a drum kit when I was 12. And I just started playing on that, and then I started taking lessons a couple years later. And I liked that. I learned a lot there from around 13, 14, 15. And then I just started playing along with records. The first record I ever played, I remember, was Graham Parker Squeezing Out Sparks. And I found out if you had headphones that were, you know, that blocked enough sound, you could play along with them, you could hear yourself. And that's where I learned a lot of my technique and all of that. And then just started playing in bands around Philly. And then in 86, I joined this band called The Right Profile that was down in Winston-Salem. And quick side note, one of the founding members of that is a guy named Stephen Dubner. And he co-wrote the Freakonomics books. So he was the guy out of all of us that did the best.
That's pretty cool, yeah. Although you're not doing too bad. You're making a living doing what you love.
Yeah.
So, well, I think we're kind of at around the end of the show. Is there anything else on the theme of the show that you would want to cover, or anything in general that we haven't talked about?
What's the phrase? And I it's a phrase that I always come back to when I get judgmental about someone's behavior or whatever. And that is, we're all works in progress. And I think that's true about everybody. I think the key is to have a level of self-awareness. A lot of people don't seem to have that. And I think if we could just be aware of how we interact with people and how we want to be treated, that I think the world would be a better place.
Yeah, remembering that the work in progress piece is really good. It is easy to fall into judgment, and as I've gotten older, I've realized how unpleasant that feels on the inside for me.
It does, yeah, it does. And one thing I'm really working on is, like you said, how that feels. How do things feel? If it doesn't feel good to judge someone, it doesn't feel good to judge or to be judged or to treat someone poorly or to be treated. So you just have to be aware of also how that makes you feel, and that will, I think, dictate how you behave also, hopefully.
Exactly. Well, thanks so much for joining us. I will be looking forward to whatever the next thing that the Worcester and Sharpling team do. We'll have links to all your various projects and places to get your comedy and music on our show notes.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks, John.
All right.
Yep. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
You can learn more about John Worcester and this podcast at oneufeed.net/Worcester. That's W-U-R-S-T-E-R, in case you didn't know. Also, we've loved getting emails and comments from everybody, so if you can, get on oneufeed.net and contact us. Let us know what you think. Thanks. This is everything that John Worcester hates right here.
Come over today and we'll make some crafts. We'll have a fellowship lunch, and while we eat some snacks, you can reap the rewards of an amazing meal. A cover dish casserole with good mouthfeel. After the luncheon, we'll drink a loaf of tea. You'll be dancing in your panties with a full belly. By then you'll be nourished and feeling calm. And we'll go to the grocer and we'll buy some balm.
Shoehorn some of those words into there. Kind of made me hate myself, even for doing that. I think I'm going to go feed my bad wolf just to cope. Actually, I'm going to feed my good wolf to my bad wolf.